And welcome back. This is Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Dr. Norman Swan. Norman is a medical doctor originally trained in paediatrics. He was one of the first medically qualified journalists in Australia with a broadcast career spanning more than 30 years. He currently hosts Radio National's The Health Report and co-hosts CoronaCast, as well as reporting in a host of ABC news shows. Norman sits on the board of the Australian Research Alliance for Children and Youth and is the co-founder of Tonic Media Network, which you may have noticed in your GP's waiting room. In this busy life, Norman has found time to write his new book, So You Think You Know What's Good For You. Norman, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Well, thanks very much, Bill.
I should mention, as stated at the beginning of Norman's book, that we are not recommending that people follow any particular medical advice. We strongly recommend that listeners consult their own health professional about their particular circumstances. So, Norman, after so many years as a journalist and listening to the medical issues that people are curious and concerned about, what is the most frequent question you hear?
Well, I think that it's more of the theme of the questions than the individual questions, but I'll come back to individual questions as well, because people are really interested in diet and exercise, and regardless of your age, staying young as long as possible. But the dominant thing that you get from the questions you get from people, and by the way, the idea for this book came from a series of talks I gave to people who were roughly the millennial age group. And what I found was that there were themes of things that they were interested in, a very switched on group of people. They had very intelligent questions to ask. But if you look at, in a sense, I use those themes as the core of the book, recognizing that everybody else, no matter what age you were, would be interested in those themes. But what sits underneath a fair bit of this, and it's independent of age group, is health anxiety. We're bombarded with information all the time. You know, eat the Paleolithic diet, it's going to make you live longer, even though in the Stone Age people only lived to the age of 28. You're going to get dementia if you don't sleep 7 or 8 hours a day. So you've got a nation that's paranoid about their sleeping habits because they think they're destroying their brains. Everybody's got a bottle of water on their desk thinking they've got to guzzle 2 liters or 3 liters of fluid a day. So there's just all this anxiety around about stuff you don't actually need to worry about that much. So what I was trying to do in the book, I was trying to be a bit lighthearted about stuff. So, you know, the biggest compliment I get about the book is that they laughed a lot during it, because I tell some very self-deprecating anecdotes during it as well. You're really emphasizing the theme that if you think it's a problem for you, then it is a problem regardless. But if you're sleeping 6 hours a night and you're feeling fine, don't let somebody convince you that you've got a medical issue. If you know, in this whole bottle of water thing on the desk, we've got something called thirst. And if you look at elite athletes now, there was a point where there was a water station, still are, in marathon runs. But the athletes were told, you've got to drink at every run. And performance levels went down, and some athletes actually got quite sick. Ethiopian high mountain runners, who often do very well in endurance events, they run at their most efficient and best when they are 2% dehydrated. So this whole rehydration, and athletes are taught, drink to thirst, don't drink to prescription. So, I mean, those are just two examples of things where we sweat the small stuff, other than sweat big stuff.
We've been living with COVID-19 for nearly 2 years in Australia, and I think your book is very timely. Do you think that Australians are more receptive now to science-based medical advice?
I think they always have been, but they are confused by the plethora of advice, where it's coming from and who do you trust. Trust is a huge issue. And I think that people's knowledge about health has gone up a lot. during this time. I spent 40 years or so broadcasting. I started at the age of six, I hasten to add. And I've never been sure throughout the time, continued to do so, to broadcast, whether people even knew what a cell was, much less DNA or RNA. mRNA trips off the tongue. People understand what a cell is. They see it every day when they look at the graphics about the coronavirus and so on and so forth. So people's knowledge has gone up, but it's gone up in a very kind of deep dive kind of way. So in other words, we've all taken a deep dive into how viruses work and how vaccines work and what RNA is. If I were to give an exam to people listening, they probably would struggle a little bit, but they kind of got a good sense of it. And the problem is that you start to look like medical researchers who know an awful lot about a little. And one of the problems in medical research is they do take a deep dive into how individual molecules work, molecular pathways and so on, and very rarely lift their head above the parapet or out of the foxhole and look around to say, what's the relevance of my molecular pathway to the meaning of life? If they did that a bit more. And the risk is that the public do that too. They just go into too narrow a foxhole and forget that it's the big stuff that really counts.
Well, some of what you say in the book, based on the latest medical advice, but it appears contrary to what we've heard before. I mean, one example was treating post-traumatic stress disorder, and you had your own experience of that. How do you feel about the treatment you received, as it might be different from what you'd get today?
Well, I didn't receive any treatment, and it wasn't recognised. So I don't think I criticise treatment in the book of post-traumatic stress disorder. I really use it as a description of something which wasn't labelled and wasn't labelled properly. And yeah, I almost died in a bus that blew up when I was the age of 14, and I had PTSD, but nobody recognised it as such. I mean, I had nightmares, I had flashbacks, and it lasted a long time. There are still vestiges of it. I still can feel very claustrophobic at times, and it was never actually properly dealt with, and it could have been. And really what I'm writing about there is not to be embarrassed about psychological issues that you may have, because we still stigmatize, and it's important to come forward for help. But what I talk about in the book is you've got to be careful what help you choose. That's really the issue, not necessarily for PTSD, but a whole range of other things.
You do put a focus on diet in the book, but not the promoted diets like paleo and low carb or low fat, or the main characteristic of diets is that they don't seem to work. But should we focus on just one consumable? Well, I'm thinking of sugar, which is everywhere.
No, that's the problem. That's what I try to get away from in the book, is that we're too focused on individual nutrients. Should I be on low carb, high carb? Should I be taking more vitamin C? Should I be taking vitamin C supplements? What about antioxidants? And so we're focused on the individuals rather than pulling back the focus to our dietary pattern. So we think about diets rather than dietary pattern. Because what counts here, so yes, I do talk a lot about diet, but dietary pattern and getting away from thinking about what I should be buying in the pharmacy and swallowing in the morning when I get up, and more to how I cook. Cuisine actually makes a huge difference to diet. The pot on the stove, what you put in the oven, how you barbecue and so on, what herbs and spices and oils you put with that make a huge difference to what you ingest in terms of what I call bioactive compounds, compounds that are going to stop internal biological rusting, the same way metal rusts, your body rusts from the inside out. And what's the best way of doing that? And there is no bottle on the shelf in the pharmacy that matches the chemistry cooking pot on your stove. Because when you mix things like extra virgin olive oil, tomatoes, onions, garlic, carrots together, cook them on a moderate heat, you release combinations of bioactive compounds that you just cannot buy over the counter. And in the right dose for you as well. And so it's not just, you've got a fad, for example, at the moment about raw diet. Now, raw, there's no question. Compared to eating processed food, go for it. Eat raw food. But in fact, you'll get even more if you cook the raw food. So a raw tomato is really good for you. But our very fine next level, if you finally chop a tomato, you actually trigger chemistry within the tomato, which releases antioxidants, potent antioxidants. But if you then cook that tomato gently in extra virgin olive oil with all the stuff that's in that, you release even more powerful compounds. And it's that knowledge that cooking, cuisine, ingredients, recipes start to become incredibly important.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Norman Swan, who is the author of a new book called So You Think You Know What's Good For You. It is the ultimate health guide from Australia's most trusted doctor. Norman, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song for us. Have you got one you've picked?
Yeah, I picked Every Time You Say Goodbye, a song by Diana Krall. I just love Cole Porter. I think he was one of the great poets of the 20th century. And Diana Krall is a great exponent of people like Cole Porter, a great singer, and gives a modern twist to it.
That was Every Time You Say Goodbye, as sung for us today by Diana Krall and specially chosen for us by our guest, Dr. Norman Swan, who is the author of a new book called So You Think You Know What's Good For You. Norman, you state that one of the main drivers for your book was the Glaswegian diet that you witnessed as a boy and what they put into their bodies. Did they think at the time that they were, what they were doing was good for them, do you think?
Diet was good or bad for you. Your diet was functional. You had to eat and get food into you, and not much thought was given to the health value of that. And, you know, and it was on in the days before full knowledge of cholesterol was there. It was still in the days before people were really believing that smoking was bad for you. People's health was not, and prevention was not to the fore. Going to a gym, growing up in Glasgow, in the days that I grew up in Glasgow, was considered something that bodybuilders did, some sort of weird activity down the back street, or boxers did. It was not something that nice people did.
With those deficiencies in diet, nevertheless, you're not a fan of the billion-dollar vitamin industry, I see.
No, because there's very little evidence that vitamin supplementation actually does you any good. There are exceptions. There are exceptions where people may have nutritional deficiencies as they get into older age. Vitamin B12, for example, I'm not making that recommendation, but there are examples where you don't absorb as well in your diet and you may need some help along, particularly as you get older and more frail. But you've got to be careful, because this is where the microbiome comes in. As you get older, the bugs in your bowel become less diverse and less health-giving and more. So paradoxically, as you get older, the microbiome feeds the aging process. And you've got to maintain a very diverse diet. And the risk is that you think that by taking supplements gets you out of jail in terms of having to cook and have an interesting diet with a lot of variety there. And if you're living by yourself and you're not interested in it and you're feeling a bit low mood-wise, you're not really motivated to do that. Yet sometimes a supplement is what you need, but you need to maintain that diversity of diet. And so, yes, I think it's largely wasted. You won't find a vitamin bottle in my cupboard in the bathroom, and you won't find, and you never have. I just don't see any value in it at all.
You distinguish in the book between stress and distress, and you say stress is normal. How do you distinguish stress and distress?
So I'll start with stress. So there's two forms of stress, really. There's acute stress. So that's the sort of thing, you go in the Big Dipper or the Ride of Death or the fun park, and that, you know, that surge of adrenaline. Or it's watching your favorite sport and you're barracking for your team and your stress levels go up. You know, are they going to make it? You know, it's the last quarter, whatever the story might be. And or there, you've got a deadline and you've got to deliver for that deadline, or you've got to give a talk. Now, that sort of stress, at its extreme, it's not that good for you. You can actually die of a heart attack from extreme stress like that if you've got coronary heart disease. But most of the time, it's quite productive, because you need that little bit of stress to give you the performance. You know, I still get a level of anxiety and stress when I've got to give a talk in front of a live audience, or I've got to go on television live or what have you. Just get that, you know, it's not paralyzing. It's just a little tingle there that boosts my performance. And without it, I wouldn't do as well. Well, whether I do as well is up to the audience to decide, but in my own feeling about whether I perform well, I need that level of stress. The toxic form of stress is chronic stress, and this is different from distress. And chronic stress is really common, and it comes from a loss of control of your life or work. It's where you feel, I cannot make decisions about my life. I'm too pressed. So it could be by poverty. It could be by social circumstances. It could be at work where you've got a lousy boss who's telling you what to do, micromanaging you rather than getting on with it. And that is very erosive in terms of your brain. Your mind and body are one. It's an early point that I make, and so you think you know what's good for you. And if you do know what's good for you, you know that you've got to have a healthy mind that's working well, because it's integrated with your body. And your mind, the brain, interacts with the environment around you. And research has shown that that changes the way your brain works, changes the way hormones, your immune system, your cardiovascular system are operated. It's high-quality research from Rockefeller University in New York. And if it goes on for long enough, you can actually get quite sick. And you've got to be able to deal with that chronic stress. And that can arise when you're chronically ill. So people who've got cancer often feel that chronic stress, because they get into the hospital system and the oncologist, the cancer specialist, is making decisions for you rather than you. And people kind of lose that ability to make decisions about their life quite early on in the cancer journey, if it's not recognized as a problem. Distress, psychological distress, is a description of really anxiety, or crudely, it's a description of anxiety and depression that come together to make you feel quite unwell. So you're on edge with a low mood. Maybe not badly enough that you get a clinical diagnosis of depression or anxiety, but enough that you do feel actually distressed. And it's a good description for it. And when you feel that way, it's not a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of problems in your life. It can be brought on by chronic stress or other multiple situations in your life. But it does mean that you need help. And recognizing it in yourself is really important. And what I do, and so you think you know what's good for you, is give you some sort of... So what I don't do, although it says it's a health guide, I actually don't at any point in the book give you advice. I actually present the evidence for and against stuff, and you make up your own mind, because most health books tell you what to do. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm treating you like an adult. You decide what you want to do, but here's the evidence you want to do it. So I give a description of some of the therapies that are available. You make your own mind up with your health professional.
You use yourself very usefully in lots of examples throughout the book, and you talk about a one-year period in your life when you had enormous difficulty and responsibility involving your mother, your partner, your daughter. What got you through that terrible period?
Well, what got me through was good friendships, social support, but also recognizing I had a problem where I wasn't able to fix it for myself. And actually, a psychiatrist friend of mine recommended a psychologist to me that he had gone to. So he had recognized in himself as a psychiatrist, and he'd gone to this psychologist. And this psychologist was just really brilliant with men. And I went in, and he was just fantastic. He took a history and worked out whether or not I was at risk of self-harm, recognized that I wasn't, and then just got me focused on the future. And it just gave me a series of very practical behavioral things to do. And within a few sessions, not very many sessions, I was sorted, because he gave me a strategy, a practical strategy to move forward. I'd have never come up with that by myself. And if a friend had advised me to do that, I probably wouldn't have listened. I needed a professional to tell me. And it was great.
Yeah, well, you've certainly come through. You're on everyone's minds at the moment in Australia. But you mentioned at one stage that the main cause of death is age. Do you think there should be more research directed at aging rather than just the symptoms that we see, and including dying?
Yeah, it has improved a lot. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, you're right, where it was investigating the diseases of aging, Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, coronary heart disease, diabetes and so on, cancer. So if you got rid of all those diseases, you'd think you'd live forever, but you actually don't, because then you've got the aging process underneath. And what is that process? And yes, you're right, we have not actually focused enough on that, but they have in recent years. And I don't talk about that in this book that much, but yeah, a lot more has, you know, should come out. It needs to be focused on in that area.
Now, in the olden days, epidemiologists were never listened to because, you know, Ebola and bird flu seemed to be contained pretty well. Now that their warnings are being taken more seriously, what do you see as the next big pandemic threat?
We have a pandemic threat which was there before, which is a pandemic of chronic diseases, which is whenever we change, this is, I'm using the phrase of a medical historian in the late 20th century, who unfortunately died too young, Sir Roy Porter. And one of his favorite phrases was, whenever we change the way we live, new diseases arise. And we should never forget that. And it's absolutely true throughout human history. And we've radically changed the way we live. We use motor cars. We globalize food supplies. We don't get enough exercise. We don't cook enough for ourselves. We don't cook healthy enough for ourselves. And we've got this epidemic, or pandemic actually it is, because it's in every continent of the world, of chronic diseases, which dementia, which we've spoken about before, cancer, coronary heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and so on. We return to that now as we move out of the pandemic through vaccination and so on. And that's ever present. If we have increasing disparities in the community between those who have and those who have not, we will see widening gaps in terms of life expectancy and where you already is the case, where you're born matters, the postcode where you're born. So if you're born in a rich suburb in Australia tomorrow, you're probably going to live to nearly 100. But if you're born in an Aboriginal community in Central Australia, you're probably only going to live to 50 or 60. The life expectancy gap in Australia is 45 years between the longest-lived suburb postcode and the shortest-lived suburb. 40 postcode, 45 years, not 11 years, 45 years. It's outrageous. So those things are, if you like, always there, and we don't notice them because they don't have the drama of a pandemic, but they are a pandemic, and they kill people, and you die too soon. And we need to be able to deal with that. And medicine is one way of dealing with it, but it's actually the root causes are actually in the way we live and the way we organize our society, the way we allow people to market unhealthy products, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's what we need to do. Now, there will be another pandemic. Might be the flu. Might be another coronavirus. That could be around the corner. It could be a biowarfare germ from a radical fundamentalist group. Those threats are ever-present. But in terms of mass deaths, it's hard to beat coronary heart disease, diabetes, obesity, cancer, dementia at the moment.
Perhaps one area for research might be the fact that consistently around the world, women live years longer than men. I wonder why that would be.
It's very complicated. The gap is narrowing between men and women in many countries. And the maybe hormonal, it's probably partly behavioral. There is a genetic propensity probably to a slightly healthier lifestyle. It's hard to know. Nobody's really explained it very well why there is that life expectancy gap between men and women, but it is narrowing.
All this, it is such an important topic, and it's so entertainingly as well as informatively covered in Norman Swan's new book, So You Think You Know What's Good For You. We've run out of time today, so it just remains for me to give a very big thank you to our guest, Dr. Norman Swan. Norman, thank you very much for being on Dad's on the Air.
It's my pleasure, Bill. Thanks for having me.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.